Backseat Producers, episode number 93, Milk. Hey, this is Tony.
And this is Daryl.
And that's it. We're the Backseat Producers. Tony number two is still on assignment in Southeast Asia. And Adam, I don't know.
Is a wall.
Yeah, he's a wuss. He got sick.
A little bug.
Yeah, very little. yeah, so... I know Adam did want to be here tonight to talk about the movie that we're going to talk about, which, for the record, the movie we are discussing is Milk. We asked Daryl if he could show up this evening because, well, for a couple of reasons. One, you joined us for the...
Oscar presentation.
Yeah, the Best Picture Showcase, mm-hmm. where we saw all five Best Picture nominated movies
back to back.
Even though you bailed on one of the movies.
Because I'd already seen it a couple of weeks before.
Yeah. You bailed on the one. And, but yeah, Adam and I stayed through all five. This is the third year I've done it. It's a cool experience, and if you can do it, It's worth it to see all those movies. You see a lot of great movies all at once. But you have to be willing to sit.
And sit.
A lot. Yeah.
It will test your manhood.
Yes, it will.
Test your bladder limits, too.
Oh. Yeah, especially if you start drinking the sodas and getting the free refills. That's bad news.
But it's a hell of a deal. I mean, if you don't see a whole lot of movies throughout the year, this is a great time to catch them up.
Yeah, I mean,
one shot.
And the prices have changed, and exactly how they do the presentation has changed a couple times in the 3 years.
Yeah, they've now got, you say, this was the first year they've had a half hour between each movie, so you had plenty of time to go.
They did have plenty of time, and they've always planned for that. In the last couple of years, they also tried to plan for a longer break at the dinner time period, and it never worked out because they always kept creeping into longer and longer breaks. They'd hit that last 2 hours or so, and they'd realize that if they really took that hour and a half long break, everything would be pushed back.
So they cut that
middle break short. So this year they said screw it, and they just made all the breaks equal, which was fine.
You've already seen one movie, you can always come back into the theater as long as you get your pass. So,
right.
And there's plenty of restaurants nearby that you can walk to or a short hop drive that you can get something fast and get back.
Right, right. And, I mean, even the theater has hot dogs and pizza and nachos.
It's got enough snacks. Plus, that's the good thing this year was they had two theaters dedicated to it. So nobody had to be jammed in.
Yeah, that was a really nice change. The first 2 years I've done this, which actually they've only been doing. I found out they have only been doing it 3 years. So I've gone every time they've done it. The first two times there was only one theater. Well, the first year there was only one theater in the St. Louis area that did it. It was the theater that we went to. Actually, in the same theater that we were in, and they only had it on one screen in that multiplex. Last year, they still only had it on one screen, but there was two different theaters in the St. Louis area. This year they had two different theaters and two different screens in our location. I don't know about the other one. But it did make it much nicer because I know the first year we were crammed in there. The second year, last year, there was a snowstorm that day. So some people didn't show up. But it was still pretty packed. Mm-hmm. And this year it was much nicer. There was a lot more room to spread out.
And that's a big sacrifice for AMC to dedicate, you know, the revenue out of two theaters for almost 12 bloody hours.
Yeah.
Plus the staff to run it that long.
Yeah. So, and the price to us was $30 a ticket.
$30. I mean,
and we had all the popcorn we wanted all day.
Soda
long.
You wanted to drink, and they gave
they didn't give you soda. You had to buy the soda.
Still, but they gave you a large bag, empty bag of popcorn.
Right.
You could go up there any time and have them fill it to the brim or get a half bag, but you could come back as much as you want.
Right.
I mean, you subtract that out right there, that's about $6 worth of popcorn.
Oh, yeah.
Your sodas are, you know, you drink maybe two or three of them at total.
Well, and what I did was the first time I bought a soda, I bought one of the big ones, so I just refilled that all day. So, big deal. But yeah, I mean, it's an interesting experience, and I know not everybody can do it. If you want to try to do something like that, rent 5 movies, sit on your couch, don't lay down, don't recline.
And get two of your
friends.
Get
two of your friends to sit next to, so you're all on the couch together. Don't pause the movie. If you get up to go to the bathroom, don't pause the movie. Just let it play. It's a test of stamina. Don't answer the phone. You know,
right? The world doesn't exist while these movies are playing.
No, it doesn't. And that's kind of cool too, because you kind of just shut everything else out for a day.
Yeah. So. It's a great way to kill an afternoon. I mean, this is sort of what people did back in the
30s. Morning, afternoon, evening.
Yeah, this is kind of what, you know, people did in the 30s and 40s. You know, they'd go to the show in the daytime, in the afternoon, and they'd stay there till, you know, evening.
Right.
Mainly because the theater was air conditioned.
Sure.
It sure felt good on a 100-degree day. I mean, you got 10 cartoons, a few newsreels, and maybe even a double feature.
Yeah. So. The one of the reasons that you joined us for viewing the movies. The second reason, though, and I think actually what's more telling for this movie is you were in the San Francisco area during part of the time that this movie covers. Yeah,
right. I was there. I came in there right after the White Knight riots, which we'll get into a little later as we kind of get into the movie.
Right. So, that said, we're talking about the movie Milk. You know, I've been kind of debating on this one if there's really any point in doing a spoiler-type section on it. Because there's...
Well, we all know how it ends.
Yeah, so. You know how it ends. It's not a big surprise. It's history. It's a point of history, and they start the movie telling you how it ends.
Right.
The opening scene. The opening scene of the movie is a spokesperson, and I didn't get the sense.
It was Harvey. He was sitting down at his kitchen table. He was recording.
No, it was there was the spokeswoman who came on and said, "We regret to announce."
Right. The TV commentator.
The commentator coming out and saying that
Harvey Milk and Dan Moscone have been killed.
So you know how it's going to end
already.
You know,
but
it's all
the stuff that leads up to it is what makes it interesting.
Right.
I want to say first thing about this movie. Sean Penn did a hell of a job being Harvey Milk. I mean, for a straight actor to play a promiscuous gay man of that era was really a tough acting job. And the way he put himself into this was convincing. He had me squirming at some of the scenes in there. It was getting a little too intense.
Yeah, it was. I watched the Oscars the next day because they always time this so that we watch these movies the day before the Oscars. I watched the Oscars, and during the way they did the Oscars is they had 5 actors come out and kind of introduce each of the five nominees.
Yeah, they were the previous Oscar winners.
Right, and they had Robert De Niro talking about Sean Penn. And he came out and said something to the effect, all these years we thought you were straight. We thought you were a straight actor, a straight man, or a how did he put that? It was who knew that all these years you were just playing straight for the movies? Mm-hmm. Because he was damn convincing. he was damn convincing as that person.
I'll tell you what, if it hadn't been Sean Penn, mm-hmm. I would have been kind of surprised.
Right.
I mean, okay, we all know what should have been like Sean Penn's offstage life is like.
Yeah.
And for him to turn into kind of like a 180-degree personality change like that,
right,
is not easy for any actor.
Right.
And to do it convincingly. Getting into the movie itself.
Before we do that, I want to comment about something in the chat room. Sarah in the chat room says, this year's picks would have made me walk in front of a car after watching them all. I would venture to say last year's picks would... I was looking for a gun on the way out to the car because they were so depressing. This year's wasn't as bad as last year's.
Well, actually, only about... You might say only had two of them really had kind of like downer innings.
Right.
That was The Reader and Benjamin Button.
Well, I mean, this one had a downer ending just because you know he's going to die at the end.
Yeah,
but it's a known quantity. I mean, you know, right, it's going to happen.
Right, but it's a downer ending that we know that he dies. But
right,
the thing is, what he accomplished during his lifetime was pretty phenomenal.
Yes, yes. All right, so we've got. In talking about the movie itself, high level overview. What did you think of the film? Like a three sentence.
Great primer for political activism. You can take it on that level.
Mm-hmm.
You could say it's a great romance in a
yeah.
rather gay sort of way.
Well, because they were gay,
right? Political primer, a good historical period piece about a part of a decade that we mostly tend to look at as being kind of boring.
Right, right. And, to be honest, until this movie came out, I had no clue who Harvey Milk was. I'd never heard the name that I'm aware of. I had not heard the name. I didn't know who he was. And so for me, it was an educational experience just learning about the man.
Yeah, I mean, you can take this movie and watch it and take notes, and this is a textbook example of how to run a grassroots political campaign.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And there's very few movies out there that really kind of get into the nuts and bolts of how do you go about winning an election.
Right. And this movie did. I mean, it talked about that, and it wasn't afraid. It didn't back down from his failures at it either,
mm-hmm.
and the strain it put on his whole life,
right, and on the life and on the lives of the people around him,
right.
I mean, he was a difficult person to be around.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he either made one minute he either made you crazy, made you angry, or made you want to go out and lead 15,000 people down the street.
Right, right.
And he's a very erratic. Well, at least as he's depicted, he's somewhat of an erratic character, prone to quick mood changes.
Yes, yes. We should probably get in and kind of go through the movie, kind of step through it and talk about it as it progresses. The movie starts. Well, the movie is told through a series of
flashbacks, through as he's talking into his
yeah as he's doing his
political
retro movie. Podcasting,
right, he's doing old school podcasting
as
you mentioned there.
He's got an old style tape recorder. He's holding a little hand mic and he's telling his story, and he pretty much says throughout the recording, this is in the event that I get assassinated. These tapes exist in the event that I am assassinated. Here's to explain who I am, what I did, and how I did
Essentially,
it.
Essentially, he was dictating his last political will and testament.
Yes, yes. So that kind of frames the whole movie, and they use that. They come back to
break up the sections of the movie.
Right, and it gives you transition points so that you can take larger leaps in time and not have to feel constrained, because the movie actually takes place over, was it like an eight or nine year period.
Well, the main part of the movie takes place between 75 and 78, when he was the most active in the Castro district.
Right.
When he was organizing, when he was trying to become a city supervisor. He actually was trying to get elected to do anything.
Right. But it actually started a little bit before that in New York.
Right. As they had it picked up there, it started in New York when he met his first partner, Scotty.
Right.
And it sort of quickly takes off from there, that they're heading out in the next scene. You know, he drops out of his rather straight corporate world job, mm-hmm. and heads out to California to the quote unquote gay paradise of San Francisco.
Well, and we also learn pretty early on that he is not out.
No.
At this point in his life, he is.
He's still
just shy of 40. He's like 39 years old. He's going to turn 40. It's the next day is his birthday.
Right. And he's working in a pretty straight-laced corporate world, a pretty closeted man.
Right.
And he's very uncomfortable with that. He's got one of those existential crises that comes with that time. You know, like, you know, where do I go from here? Do I continue to just live a lie, or to be true to myself?
Right. And he chooses to be true to himself, and he runs off to California with Scotty. Scotty, played by James Franco, not as convincing to me as Sean Penn was as Harvey Milk. And where I noticed it was in the scenes where they kissed. Because it's big as life. They don't shy away from it. They don't hide it.
No, that was the parts that made me kind of squirm a little bit.
It's going to make a lot of people squirm. You know, it's not comfortable for most of straight America to see gay men kiss 25 feet tall.
Yes, and they're doing it really passionately. Yeah. I mean, it's not like they're trying to fake it.
And what was weird was, in my mind, I was watching it, and I started just watching it kind of analytically. And Sean Penn was going for it. Mm-hmm. He was full on invested in the moment, and James Franco always seemed to be pulling away.
He was more passive.
Yes.
About it.
Yeah. And it wasn't really a character thing, though. It was just uncomfortable.
It's not an easy scene for someone to do that.
No.
I mean,
no.
Even if they were straight actors, man and woman, to do that kind of a passionate love scene is difficult because you've got all the distractions of the crew around you. It's really hard. You really have to be a total professional to be able to push all that out and just concentrate on the scene.
And that scene and the scenes throughout the movie, Sean Penn deserved the Oscar he won.
Oh yeah, he absolutely brought an intensity to the role.
Did. Yes,
and I don't deny him anything else. Even you compare him to all the other actors that were up on the screen at the time, he had the most difficult role to get through.
Oh yeah, absolutely. So jumping back into the story, they're in the Castro district. They decide. Their unemployment money is running out.
Right.
They're running out of money for which to buy their pot.
And, right, yes, another crisis point in their life. I mean, you're out of weed and you're out of money.
They needed to do something
fast.
So they decided to open a camera shop. And they quickly find out that they're not really welcome.
No, the Castro district, just to let you know, in that time period of San Francisco, was a blue-collar working-class district. And it was slowly transitioning to something else. There was a lot of the gay people had started moving into the area because the Haight-Ashbury was the last remnants of the Flower Children.
Right.
And that was, you know, heading downhill real fast. And Castro was still decent enough, and the rents were, well, reasonable for San Francisco, if you can ever call rents in San Francisco reasonable. And it just kind of gravitated. There was already a stable gay population there, so they just gravitated towards that area. And the end of the first scene, they're opening up their camera shop, and the guy from in the I guess it was the liquor store across the streets comes over and tells him how much he hates them.
Yeah, and tells him that he's going to do everything he can to run him out of town.
Right.
He's going to get the police involved, and they will run him out of town.
Yeah, and one thing to put in a little historical perspective here, San Francisco, the police department, was totally just evil towards anybody. Well, I'll just say anybody who was not white, straight, or working class.
Yeah.
I mean, they were little more than a bunch of brown shirts mm-hmm. at the time.
Yeah.
And gays just set them off even more so than anything else. They would go out of their way to make life difficult for them.
And they spoke to that in the movie. They touched on it.
Well, I think they
touched on it enough to get the point across without
actually
getting ridiculous.
It. Well, they didn't actually show it. It was always alluded to mm-hmm. everywhere that, you know, the cops are not on our side. Nobody is really on our side except yeah. us.
Well, and the filmmakers made an interesting choice not to show it, to not push that angle of it, because they could have garnered a lot more sympathy for those characters, but they didn't need it.
Yeah.
Those characters, they didn't need the crutch of showing somebody get beat up just because they're gay.
Mm-hmm.
That would have weakened.
Well,
I think it would have weakened the whole movie.
The story, a
yeah,
lot. I mean,
it does.
It's a cheap shot to get, you know, like say, to gain sympathy.
Right.
If the threat is always out there, looming but not seen, it makes for a more interesting story.
Yeah, and it kind of makes it more ominous whenever the police are on scene, because you don't know what their intentions are. And how they're going to react to whatever's going on.
There's only a few scenes in this movie where the police are ever shown in any sort of a presence. It is always in riot gear, of course.
Oh, yeah.
But you never see, you know, the casual sort of violence that goes on every day. And at that point, you know, where the liquor store owner across the street, you know, has just, you know, walked away, and they give him the, like, yeah, have a nice day sort of stuff. And at that point, it's Harvey who decides that he's going to organize all the merchants on the street. They can't join the Street Merchants Association, so they're going to form a Gay Merchants Association
yeah.
and play the same game. And at that point, things start to happen for them. Their organizing efforts are a success. And
he's become a de facto political leader.
Well, he was all referred to as the mayor of Castro Street.
Right.
And he starts bringing the business into the area, even so, even the street merchants are starting to benefit from this. So that kind of
yes.
takes some of the edge off, because there is a scene after that is where, you know...
that was a great scene.
The guy is just inundated with customers, and he can't collect the money fast enough. You know, and Harv and Scotty walk in and say, yeah, like, how's business? And, like, the guy's sitting there looking at them, not knowing whether to hate them or thank them.
Yeah. But, I mean, he does actually thank them, though. He can't not. Because if he...
Well, this is his dream come true. That's
yeah.
what they've been trying to do for years, is, you know, trying to make this area of town a viable tourist area.
And it is. For a very narrow market... But it's a narrow market that wants they want someplace comfortable and safe and not to feel discriminated against, and that ends up working.
And that's the beginning of his more or less political career.
Yes,
is when
yes.
he starts becoming a quote unquote successful businessman.
Yes,
and nothing says success like success.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, he gets into the more there are more things that are coming down the pike, and he decides he wants to get a bigger involvement into this. One of the things where he gets some of his real political muscle behind him is that they organized a boycott against Coors beer.
That was interesting.
Because Coors...
That was really interesting
yeah,
to me.
One thing you got to understand about Coors beer at this time is the owners of Coors beer... were so far to the right of the political spectrum, mm-hmm. they came around and touched themselves on the other side. And they had a, and they just had a bucket load of money to throw at these ultra right-wing causes. Mm-hmm. And, of course, you know, this all comes from their beer sales. Well, the first thing they did, well, the Teamsters came to Harvey because he knew he was, you know, a force in that area.
Right.
And they said, okay, help us organize a boycott with all the gay bars here, not to get Coors, and we'll help you later on. And yep. he said, okay, the reciprocal deal was they had to hire more gay Teamster drivers.
Right.
But that was, again, his first... And his first, first
and in
real political base there.
In a Teamster environment, openly gay drivers in the early 70s...
Were pretty thin.
That's not a big group, if there's any of them.
If at all.
Yeah.
But the thing was, he successfully organized this boycott, so much so that Coors backed down and did the deal with the Teamsters. The Teamsters, you know, reciprocated on their agreements, and at that point he gained the labor movement behind him. So that gave him a bigger, now a really big political base that he could work with. And from there on, he went out and tried to gain a larger office. His first shot was to try to get the county supervisor position.
Right.
And that was the next part of the story was his quote unquote meteoric rise in politics.
Yes.
Although that meteoric rise took several years.
Well, and it took a big toll on his relationships, especially the relationship with Scotty.
Oh, yeah. Well, Scotty was the first victim of it. Like,
right.
He was like, you know, all political spouses. At some point, you know, the candidate has to choose between his personal life and his political cause.
Yes.
And in this case, there was just not enough of Harvey Milk to go around. You know, the late nights, the constant organizing, the meetings and everything else, you know, took a toll on his personal life, and Scotty ended up leaving him.
Right. And it would be really easy to judge Scotty for jumping out of the situation, but considering how they started, and they started kind of just as a whim and a flirtation that just
serious.
Kept going, Scotty still had that.
He still loved him.
He still loved him, but he still had his party side.
He wasn't as committed to this cause
right.
that Harvey was. I mean, Harvey was all in, and Scotty was, you know, was standing on the edge.
And it was, I think one of the most telling scenes was the scene when they're all are organizing, and Scotty's kind of off scene, and he comes in and he says, okay, everybody out.
Right.
Everybody out of the apartment. They all leave. And then the two of them just sit down to dinner. And I think that kind of explained their relationship and how strained it was. And you could kind of see Scotty's point in understanding that that's not what he signed on for, really.
Right. Yeah, we were going to open a camera store and live a nice, quiet life as merchants.
Partying with our friends.
Yeah, you know, working when we have to, having enough money. I didn't sign on to be your political spouse.
Exactly.
And, you know, that's not an uncommon problem with all people who are seeking sort of office, is, you know, where does the personal life end and the political life end?
Right.
I mean, divorce among politicians is pretty high up there. Mm-hmm. When you look at it. So for anybody thinking of running for any sort of high office, be sure to get the old lady on board first and make them watch this movie to get an idea of just this is what could happen.
Yeah. Especially the end. You have to be aware of everything that could happen.
Everything that goes on. And that's something that they dealt with all through the movie, was his constant stream of death threats that he got. He tended to say, okay, I'm not going to let this bother me. In fact, I'm going to put them up on the refrigerator and admire them.
Yes.
I'm not going to let the haters get to me.
Yeah, and he even said, you know, if we put it in the drawer and we hide it away, then it becomes scary. We've put it into the dark.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's in the light. We can see it. It's not as scary.
Right. It's there every day, and you can look at it and just dismiss it like everything else.
Exactly. Exactly.
Later on, we get into the part of his story where he's trying to bring in the elites of San Francisco behind his cause, and he finds out, well, you have the quote-unquote old gay money.
Right.
That is, like, too timid to try to get behind a fireball like him.
Right, because he's out and open, and they're gay, but they're not...
They're still semi in the closet.
Right.
They're
people know that they're gay, but they're not going to bathhouses.
They're not making a fuss about it.
Yeah. Yeah, they're not making a scene.
Right.
They're not walking in parades. They're not, you know, down in the Castro. They're not out.
They're living
in that
rather middle class American life.
Yes.
And they're not flaunting it at people.
Right.
And that's the way they like it. I mean, they're gonna work carefully
and they're gonna protect
the system.
That.
Yeah. They're gonna work carefully inside the system and make the little gradual changes, which again for Harvey is just too slow. I mean, they've been doing it for years and they haven't got anywhere.
Yes. Yes.
And that was his thesis right there. It's time to get up and make some noise.
Now, before that, he had actually touched on it, but what I think one of the things that I found really cool about the character was that Harvey Milk was a showman.
Yeah.
As well as an activist. When he makes his first big speech in the Castro, he walks out with a big wooden box that has the word soap
on it.
Very sloppily painted on it. Just making a ridiculous statement that he was going to get up on his soapbox.
Yeah, and this is still when he was still more or less, still a little hippy-dippy.
Yes.
From the time. He's still got the torn t-shirt, the ponytail, and whatnot, in the jeans with the holes in them. I mean,
yes.
He was still trying to be a quote-unquote man of the people.
Right,
but
right.
He found out pretty quick that doesn't sell too well to the people you're trying to reach. They want to
exactly.
see a little bit more buttoned-down appearance.
Yes.
If you're going to be a leader, you need to quote unquote look like a leader.
Yeah, I mean, he had to fit in with at least the image of what
a politician
looks like. Yeah.
Right.
One of the other things that I liked about him was he started every one of his rallies with "I'm here to recruit you." It wasn't, you know, listen to me talk at you. It's come join me.
Right. I'm trying to persuade you to my view. I'm not.
And he tells you flat out up front, I'm here to recruit you. I'm, you know, he didn't back down from it. He didn't shy away from it. He knew his position. He went and spoke before very straight people.
Well, that's what he was. He that's one of the things that they came to the conclusion early is if you want to be a politician of your a political leader of your district, and this is kind of the way they bring out in the movie, is this was not a very concentrated enclave. The Castro district still had a lot of working class blue collar people there.
Yes.
So you couldn't just carry your office on the gay vote. I mean, that was impossible. We had to appeal to everybody, and you just couldn't be a politician just for this narrow ethnic group. You had
and
to
they did actually,
broaden it up.
Yeah, and they did actually speak to the regional boundaries of the area and, you know, that there was an Irish Catholic influence in mm-hmm. this area. There's, you know, the Castro district. There's, you know, some of the other areas that have different influences and different ethnic groups and things
right.
like
You've
that.
You've got to appeal you to win that kind of that election under the rules they had at the time, the way the districts were the wards were drawn.
Right.
You had to appeal a lot more broadly.
Yes, yes, and that was during the first couple of runs that he made.
Right, and his first run, you know, he lost by something like 7,000 votes. And then in the next election, he lost by only a few thousand. But each time he ran, he got more sophisticated in his approaches, in his policies, and his he toned down the activism a little bit, but you know, still did not lose the progressive tone he was trying to get. And he also gained more allies, more labor behind him. He started getting noticed at City Hall that this guy, this Milk guy could have potential here. He's looking like he's doing all the right things. He's just not some flash in the pan loudmouth.
One of the things that really impressed me, and I would love to know just how many of the moments of this movie are God's honest truth and how much are fiction just for the point of storytelling. Because I'm sure that some of it is. You can't know everything.
Well, there's always a certain amount of dramatization.
Yeah, you always have to add some drama to it. But after his second or third run, and the guy that he was up against that beat him, just barely beat him for the last spot, kind of almost pulled him aside and told him, you know, you need to change how you do things.
Right.
You're not doing it the right way. If you really want to win, you can't just be a gay politician. You have to be a politician
of the people.
You have to be a politician who just happens to be gay.
Right.
And he gave him some really good advice just in that moment. It was really cool to see somebody step aside who was a competitor, mm-hmm. who was straight, who had no business helping him, really.
Yeah,
but he did.
Yeah, but the thing
but
is,
that was the kind
he
of
was gaining
person.
Respect even from his competitors.
Yeah,
that hey, you know, you're not a bad guy, but you know, you just got to change your approach a little bit.
You can do some good things, but you need to learn.
They saw the passion in him, and they pretty much were on the same.
They realized he was just kind of ignorant to the situation. How the machine works.
Just to figure out how the machine works.
Right. So he gets to the point where he's making what he assumes to be his last run at it. Win or lose, this is it. He's promised Scotty that, you know, after this, if they lose, it's over. We're just gonna go back to having our life. And then there's if I'm remembering right, that's when they lost. But there's the redistricting.
Right, because at the time that they were doing it, the districts were drawn in such a way that you had to win a certain majority. Then they were redistricted to where your boundaries included his entire power base.
Yes.
And he didn't have to worry about bringing in the fringe elements anymore.
Right.
So that gave him an enormous leg up. And he decides to launch another shot at it. Of course, that's when, you know, his personal life starts unraveling somewhat.
Right. Scotty says, I'm done. You know, and rightfully so. I mean, to this point, you can kind of see his point. And he says, you know what? I want to be first. This is first. And he leaves.
Right. It's over with him.
Yeah.
I mean,
he's done.
He's seeing the fact that he's always going to be backseat.
Nice plug.
Yeah.
By the way.
Yeah, backseat to Harvey's ambitions. I mean, this is Harvey's passion. Whatever passion he sort of felt for Scotty has long since cooled. This is a lot more important.
Yes. Yes.
Well, there's another thing, too, that Scotty was probably starting to feel was the group of people he had around him. This is something that we need to touch on here, too. He had a really eclectic bunch of lieutenants around him that he, quote-unquote, recruited.
And they do kind of touch on how he recruited each of them in the bizarre ways that he did recruit them.
Yeah. And this you got to remember, his whole power, I mean, political organization was running out of this camera shop. And it was kind of like just total chaos in there every day of him, you know, running the camera shop and running this political organization. I mean, you think about how loose that is by today's standards. I mean, you could not literally do that because there's just too much reporting and financial things you have to do. But back in the 70s, political activism was still something of a still done as a do-it-yourself project without having a lot of the big financial oversight.
Right. Well, and a lot of the financial requirements
were not as stringent. Yeah,
yeah.
You didn't have to be so. No, you didn't have to really account for your money that closely.
Exactly.
Of course, he didn't have a whole lot to start with.
Right. Right.
I mean, one thing they say in the movie is, you know, his entire finance was out of the cash register of the camera shop.
Right. So at this point, he's already cleaned himself up. He's already taken on the more professional appearance, and he did that before his last big run that we mentioned. There's a redistricting, and he decides that he's not going to go just for the
council seat.
Yeah, the council seat.
He's going to go for the county supervisor seat.
Right. He's going for a much bigger position. And he's got a really good shot at it based on the way the district's
been relayed out now. And the topic he picks to base his whole campaign on is dog poop.
Yeah, he found something that everybody is bugged by, and it's not a gay or straight thing. It's something that is universal and is a problem. It is apparently a big problem where they're at this time that needs to be taken care of, and somebody needs to do something about it. And if he's taking on that thing to break the ice.
Right. And he puts on a big political theater about it, gets his name in the paper and on the evening news and all that sort of stuff, you know. And he from that genesis, he starts reconstituting his power base again. And this time, of course, it pays off.
In a big way. Mm-hmm. He takes it. He gets his political victory.
Right. And this is the beginning of now the real headbutting that goes on. This is where Dan White walks into the picture.
And Dan White is played by Josh Brolin.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting character. He is the guy in the next ward over that is probably, I mean, the way I understood it when they talked about the redistricting, Dan White is probably the guy that would have always won that ward until Harvey comes along in the redistricting. Now it's actually drawn the lines to where they both can take that position and be in that place.
And plus there is some overlap between their districts too.
Right.
There's some things that they policy wise they have to work on. And this is where now things start moving. The whole story starts to get a lot more intense. This is the beginning of his conflict with Dan White. And just to give you a background of who Dan White was, Dan White, you say what he said was, he was the other county supervisor on the Board of Supervisors.
Right.
And Dan White was the complete antithesis of everything Harvey was. He was a family man. He was a
conservative, straight.
He was an ex-police officer, an ex-firefighter. He was a Vietnam veteran. And he represented everything that Harvey Milk wasn't.
Yes. Yeah. They were the opposite sides of the coin, literally. I mean, they couldn't have been more different. Harvey was small and wiry and kind of spastic, and Dan was strapping and
rather
and solid
and he was more cautious,
somber,
in his approach.
Yeah.
Yeah. But the thing is, you know, White realizes he has to have Harvey on his side on some things in order to get something done. Well, that's the way politics is.
Sure.
There is a lot of give and take. You know, there's one supervisor, like they put in the movie here, their first bone of contention was that there was a psychiatric hospital that resided in the district, and it was going to be, Dan White wanted it out of his district.
Right.
And he needed Harvey's vote to get it closed. Initially, Harvey said, sure, I'll help you out with that. So he makes a promise to Dan.
But he also wanted something from Dan.
Right.
Which is, it's kind of a side story that at some point we were going to have to bring in to the conversation, and this is probably as good a point as any, and that is this political movement.
Right. This was all starting.
That's starting in another part of the country, and it's growing.
Right.
It's the beast that's coming, and you can they really set it up as the big bad. It is.
Well, yeah. This is
the demon on the horizon that is getting
right,
closer.
This is the thing that's going to split them apart. And to lay into this a little bit, in other parts of the country, there had been in the early 70s. Initiatives put on the constitutions of many cities and states,
right,
an anti-discrimination ordinances that could not discriminate against sex, gender, or even orientation.
Yes.
Now, these ordinances were an anathema to the right-wing conservatives. And this is the slow nucleus of the right-wing starting to formulate into this movement.
Right.
And the first spokesman they had was a woman named Anita Bryant. And Anita Bryant was this rather mediocre singer who was the spokesman for the Florida Orange Juice Board.
Right.
She's the one who coined the term a day without orange juice is like a day without sunshine. And her commercials ran all over the country, so everybody kind of knew who she was. She'd had a couple of hits back in the 60s, but she was like America's wholesome virgin. I mean,
yes.
All she had to do was just like ascend from heaven or something like that. Well, she became the frontman for the repeal of this ordinance first in Dade County.
Mm-hmm.
And she and the conservative movement there essentially attacked this whole ordinance in her words, that since gays cannot have children, the only way they can reproduce themselves is to seduce children in the schools to become gay. Now, you think about that today, how just ridiculous that sounds. But back in that time, that was some pretty incendiary stuff.
Right.
And there was a lot of people who wanted to believe that.
Sure, whether they knew that it wasn't true or not, it was convenient.
It was something that the conservatives could hang their hat on and get back at, quote-unquote, their liberal adversaries.
Yes.
So she became this huge spokesman for this entire movement. And first, the first thing that happened was the Dade County Ordinance was repealed. And then later on, these initiatives started in other states and in other cities, and they were having a series of successes in getting them repealed. Now, something you got to know about Anita Bryant. The press absolutely despised her.
Really?
They could not stand her. She was the most in-your-face, ignorant statements just poured out of her. You could put a camera in front of her.
Well, and they did touch on that in the movie, that just some of the things that she said were just inane.
I know, but that's the way she was. She was so convinced in her faith and in her political cause that no stupid statement could ever be left unsaid. Just to give you an idea of how just despised she was in the press, in the 70s, I had a favorite comic book called Howard the Duck.
Yes.
They even did a 2-issue parody of her. They didn't name her directly, but in it, you pretty much knew who it was.
Nice.
I mean, if that meme can penetrate all the way down to a rather obscure comic book at the time.
Well, Howard the Duck was kind of subversive. I mean,
it was
a mainstream subversive comic book.
Well, it was a parody and a satire. Yeah. I mean, no subject was unsafe for them, even other comic books.
Right.
And they had a field day with popular culture. Mm-hmm. That's what it was. It was essentially a parody of popular culture to start with. But, you know, they occasionally would go off on a rather serious tack, disguised as a satire.
Sure.
So now we have Anita is just gaining all this huge popularity. She becomes the big boogeyman.
Right.
So now enter this wave of change is moving to the West, So it comes to a guy named Biggs, who was a California assemblyman.
Mm-hmm.
And this, he decided he's going to raise this issue in the California Assembly. And they had a thing called Proposition 6. Mm-hmm. Now, Proposition 6 was the same thing as all the other ordinances. It repealed a lot of the anti-discrimination ordinances. But it went one better. The way it went was that you could not acknowledge, promulgate any sort or attribute anything that had to do with homosexuality in the public schools. Teachers had to be totally down on homosexualities, or they could lose their jobs.
Right.
You could not be neutral. You could not be positive. You had to condemn it, and you had to condemn it loudly and publicly.
Wow.
I mean, it was essentially the McCarthy loyalty oath just turned on its side. And this became known as the Biggs Initiative. And this is the next big story in the Harvey Milk saga, is his takeoff to fight Proposition 6.
And this is, but this story has been building through the course of even his run at the last office that he gets. This, it's been building. Mm-hmm. It's been growing. It's still in the distance. It's still not local. It's still not something he can do anything about. Well, he really doesn't even see it coming. Harvey pretty much goes out and says, I want them here. I want to fight them on my turf. I want to stop them, but I want to stop them here.
I want to stop them in San Francisco and in California.
Let's see if we can bring them here and shut them down where they need to be shut down.
And this is the point where they all have to get real serious about this. And this is their camp meeting at the store, where Harvey puts up everybody the challenges. He says, okay, we're going into this on the more or less national level. This is no longer just Castro. It's just no longer San Francisco. This is California, and if not the whole United States.
Right.
And
even at the time, California and San Francisco, you know, if they're going to stop, if they're going to repeal those laws in California, the rest of the country might as well just give it up now.
Well, that was
just
the go idea. Ahead and
write it back now.
I mean, if you're going to take supposedly the most liberal state in the union,
yes,
outside of Massachusetts, and you're going to get this passed, you're pretty much setting the tone for everybody else. And this is where the biggest part of the climax of the story begins, is with Harvey saying to his constituents, well, his lieutenants, he said, okay, no more being in the closet. You got to come out, and you got to come out to your families. You got to come out publicly, because we can no longer keep this anymore a deep, dark secret.
Yes.
And this is something his lieutenants have a hard time dealing with, because a lot of them ran away from family and friends.
So they wouldn't have to come out.
So they wouldn't have to.
So they didn't have to face that.
Go through that conflict. And
Harvey's point is, in that really is that if you can't be honest with yourself and those around you, then you probably
can't be honest in this thing.
You're not gonna deserve the rights that we're fighting for,
right? Unless you're willing and to you're put not some,
and you're not gonna
on the line.
Yeah, you're not gonna put everything you have into this.
And this is the point where they start the campaign against the Biggs Initiative. And we see the whole beginning of this is now going, they're going to go, this is going to go head to head. This is no longer just a local thing. And their initial surveys that they bring out, or it don't look good. I mean,
yes,
the majority of the state is for Proposition 6.
Right.
So they have a lot of education to do. So they go through, we see the big marches and rallies, and Harvey's followers and lieutenants are just pouring themselves into this. And to bring into now some more conflict into the story, Harvey has now got a new partner.
Yes.
This the guy he brings, he picks up, and literally picks up.
Yes.
Is completely, he's a little too tightly wound up. Total drama queen, total dependent, clingy, whiny.
And a little bit nuts.
Totally. Well, yeah, he's not exactly all there.
And by a little bit, I'm underplaying that in a big way.
Yeah.
Because that guy is completely crazy.
Right. He's bouncing off the wall the majority of the time. Every time Harvey's five minutes late getting home, the guy is just in total emotional meltdown mode.
Right.
And, you know, this, you know, here's the last thing you need is this sort of drama while you're trying to save civilization, literally.
Yeah. So you've got this guy as a huge distraction. One of the things we kind of missed in talking about Harvey and his influence. There were times. Even before he achieved the political office, that he was encouraged to rally the people and to get them to do something. I'm struggling to remember the situation in the context of the film, but he was actually basically asked to get everybody under control because they were about to riot.
Well, yeah, that was one of the
repeals in another part of the country.
Right. They had got out, the word had gotten out, people were pouring into the streets somewhat uncontrollably. Well, this one lieutenant of his, rather young kid, who has a great gift for organizing crowds.
Yes.
Harvey puts the megaphone in his hands and he says, okay, get in front of the line and start shouting chants and get them to start following you and just have them lead them to City Hall. I'll get down to City Hall. You know, the cops and everything are going to be out there. Stop in front of City Hall. I'll come out, make a quote-unquote an announcement in a speech. The crowd will calm down. I'll be seen as
a hero.
A hero.
Yeah.
Because I averted a riot.
Yes.
So he was not quite above, you know,
I mean,
a little grandstanding.
And yeah, exactly. He was a showman. He manipulated a situation that could have turned very ugly, very violent, but he manipulated it into a huge political boost.
And a huge amount of political theater.
Oh, yeah.
He got, you know, Harvey Milk, man on the scene, you know, stops riots single-handedly.
Right. He has his people under control.
Well,
I mean, that was kind of, you know, looking at it from another way. Mm-hmm. You know, he's got people willing to stop a riot.
Well, actually, get out in front and take control of it.
Exactly.
And it's not quite an easy thing to do while you've got a lot of emotions and anger going on.
Yep. Okay, so back to the point we're at later in the film.
Right, they're doing, it's the Biggs initiative that's going on. And the results are starting to come in, and it's still...
It's looking bad.
It's looking bad.
It's not looking good.
And then, you know, the big climax is, it's suddenly Orange County and several counties in L.A. went the other way.
Right.
And that threw them
over the top. Even then, the I believe that they showed a television report, and the reporter says something like, "The polls are wrong. the exit polls are wrong from what we are seeing now. The votes are not going the way that we had projected them previously." And they had to basically redo their projections
all over
on the fly. And apparently, it was not repealed. And it went down to
a huge defeat.
Yes.
And it was across the entire political spectrum. It wasn't just a narrow vote. It was enormous.
And it was across the state. It wasn't in just his area.
Right.
LA, they got different parts of California.
They picked up the areas that, you know, would typically been rather conservative.
Sure.
But somewhere along the line, their education and common sense prevail. And the Biggs Initiative failed.
Yes, yes.
So Harvey is the big man of the day. Now he's gained enough power that he can now kind of call the shots, even to the mayor.
Yes. The mayor.
Moscone, yes.
The relationship that Moscone and Harvey had was fascinating. Because there was no... There didn't seem to be any tension between them about Harvey's his sexual preference at all. It seemed to be very casual, almost friendly. Every time we saw the two of them together, it was a supportive relationship.
Right.
It was a very supportive relationship between those two.
Because essentially Moscone had a progressive agenda that matched Harvey's, yes. And he needed people like him on the Board of Supervisors to support his policies that he was trying to get done through in San Francisco
right.
there.
Right. And from the look of it, Dan White was probably more the odd man out than anybody was.
He was slowly being marginalized by everybody.
Yes. His vote was nullified on a number of things because Harvey had more people on...
Well, more people would join behind him.
Right. The causes that he was behind fell more in line with the rest of the group. And it was easier to pull them toward his way of thinking on those things.
Yeah, this is something the movie sort of kind of has this little undercurrent here that White was sort of a tool of the right wing. Or he was trying to be.
And I don't know if I was just reading into this or if this was really what they were trying to imply, but it almost seemed to be that Harvey was implying that Dan White was in the closet.
Yes, that's something they dance around quite a bit because he would often, you know, kid Dan
yes.
about this. And, you know, White would be get uptight and uncomfortable.
Right.
You never knew whether he was just being uptight and uncomfortable or was he was afraid that, hey, he's onto something. You know, they drop that hint quite a bit. But the real truth is Dan White was straight.
Yeah, and he's straight, had a wife, a couple of kids. But Dan White also had a problem with Harvey.
Well, he had a lot of problems.
He had a lot of problems, but the background he had, all the problems that he had with how he was being marginalized, and his constituency couldn't handle him being marginalized, especially by a gay man.
Right.
It was a huge problem for him.
And his ego.
And his ego, yeah, because he actually resigned.
Yes.
He gets to the point of resigning. He submits a resignation letter. And there's a scene where Harvey just happens to catch him being pulled aside by somebody from the police board.
Right.
And
they go into
they kind of go into a side room.
They go to a side room.
And then all of a sudden after that, Dan doesn't want to resign.
Yeah, he wants his job back. And that's, you know, the historical truth is that White did resign. He handed his resignation to Mayor Moscone. And then 2 weeks later, he's back in Moscone's office, you know, demanding that he get his seat back.
Well, right.
Moscone says, well, you snooze, you lose. I mean, I got somebody I'm going to put in there who's going to be
And this is after Harvey has already gone to the mayor and said, hey, this is what's happening. I think you need to be aware of this before something hinky goes on.
Well,
again, so Harvey kind of helped his cause by making sure the mayor was aware that Dan may not be his own man. Or even less of his own man than one would assume
right,
as a politician.
He's trying to essentially say he's more of a liability
yes.
than an asset at this point.
Right.
He's an obstruction. Or at least the people he's representing are using him like a cat's paw.
Yes. Yes. So Dan is fired.
Well, he's not really fired.
Well, he's not really fired.
But he's not going to
get his resignation has been accepted, and it will not be rejected. It will not be overturned.
Right.
So he's out.
Yeah.
But he doesn't really take that well.
No, he doesn't.
And this is the only spoiler to the movie, really. And it's been projected through the whole film. And the film at this point has actually been getting a little more tense. You know it's coming, and it's coming quick, just because the way the character looks when he's recording his
testament,
whatever it is, his testament, is very similar to how he looks at this point in the movie. Everything's coming together, and it really feels that way, that everything is all being pulled together. Scotty has made an appearance back in his life.
The guy he was with has committed suicide.
Yes.
That's kind of one of the underlying themes of our five movies,
too. Yeah, there was a hanging theme that went through a couple of them. At this point, then, Dan sneaks back into the city hall, goes into the mayor's office, kills him, goes down to Harvey's office,
and pulls him aside,
and
pumps fire,
guns him down. Yeah, he guns him down.
Yeah. After that that's the point at which the movie more or less pretty much ends.
Right.
Is Harvey's death at the hands of Dan White, and it kind of winds up there. You know that this has been Harvey's legacy.
Yes.
Now the actual truth is, after that, Dan White ran out of City Hall, down to a police station, and turned himself in a couple of days later. Mm-hmm. He confessed on the spot that he had murdered Mayor Moscone and Harvey White. And it later comes out, several years later, he was also gunning for two other board members. But we don't know that at the time.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was something they didn't really talk about in the film.
Well, they're going for maximum impact.
Right. And the film story is really about Harvey. It's not about everybody else.
Yeah. And the wrap-up of the story is, at this point, is, you know, where do all the other members of Harvey's war council kind of go to? And the legacy that Milk left behind. And
one of the things that I found kind of interesting in watching the Academy Awards when the writer won for screenplay, and he was thanking a number of people, it was humorous to me because the people he was thanking were characters in the movie, which you always kind of have the disconnect that you're watching a movie, there's actors playing characters, it's not real because of that.
Yeah,
but then you hear those quote unquote character names as someone that the writer is thanking. It's because they're real people. Those are the real people.
He's lived with them all this time.
These are the people that he interviewed, those people to make this story, to make it happen.
Yeah, and they pick up the end at this point. Now the final conclusion was what happened to Dan White was the most bizarre and tragic.
Yeah.
Point where, because of his confession, his trial was not very long. His trials started only about 6 months later, in May of 79. And his defense was, or at least his lawyer's defense was, that Dan was suffering from depression brought on by massive consumption of sugary food. The press picked up on this and referred to it as the Twinkie defense.
Yes.
In other words, they were trying to say diminished capacity.
Right.
Well, the jury bought this. And instead of going for murder one, he was only convicted of manslaughter three, which only carried a penalty of 8 years.
Mm-hmm.
And he got out 5 years later after his conviction.
Right.
But, you know, he was a complete pariah.
Yeah,
to everybody.
Was, yeah.
I mean, the man could not go anywhere because he carried this stigma around with him.
Mm-hmm.
He was divorced a couple of years later, and then he committed suicide in 1984.
Right.
The weird way was, though, he essentially committed suicide by running his car in the garage while listening to a tape on the cassette player. Bizarre. I mean,
yeah.
This was a guy who apparently just didn't get it the entire time.
Yeah, yeah.
He's kind of a tragic character when you really think about it, because here was a guy who was pretty much an all-American boy and just gets up and just shoots, you know, just guns down two people after having been a police officer.
Yeah.
And seeing what this kind of violence, you know, does.
And he's got a young family.
And he's got a family, he's got a wife, he's got kids, and yet he goes in and just kills two people. And the best excuse he could say is, I ate too much junk food.
Right, right.
The aftermath of that was after White's conviction, California wiped out the diminished capacity defense.
Ah, okay.
There is no such thing anymore after that. Because of such a huge miscarriage of justice there.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that was... It was obviously nothing to do. I mean, if the movie tells it the way it is, it was completely a bitter, spiteful, broken man acting out. I mean, that's exactly
acting
what it was.
Acting out of rage and ignorance.
Yes.
But the story was a tad bit more complex than that. But it essentially it provides a nice conclusion.
Yes, yes. Interestingly enough, most of the people who were his lieutenants, his war council, went on to do more things, great things in their own right.
Yeah, they became political activists in their own right and went on to better positions of power, and they started becoming active in their own communities. And, of course, some of them met tragic ends in the AIDS epidemic of the early 80s, which was, again, not too unsurprising because... Mm-hmm. By the time I had come onto the scene in California in 79, the AIDS thing was just starting to raise its ugly little head. And by 1980, it was starting to really be noticeable. And one of the big controversies in San Francisco at that time was the gay bathhouses.
Right.
Whether they should be closed as a health hazard.
Yeah.
And there was a huge controversy on that. So I think we pretty much wrapped it up there.
Yeah, I mean, we've talked through pretty much the whole movie. I think one of the questions that comes out of the movie after watching the movie and seeing what he accomplished in a relatively short period of time.
Right.
I mean, realistically, the movie taken from the beginning before he's still in the closet, a businessman in New York. To the point where he dies.
Right.
It's a span of, is it 8 years?
Yeah, a little less than the 1970s.
Yeah, it was because he's just about to turn 40, and he even makes mention,
well, he was,
for dramatic effect, I'm sure, that he's not going to make it to 50.
Well, he says that early on, but he was, what, 57, 56 or so when he died, so...
No, he was 48.
48, okay.
Yeah, right. He didn't make it to 50. It was less than 10 years because he had his 40th birthday, and he was only like 47 or 48 when he died.
So he was really just coming into his, you know, most productive period. It begs the question is what would have happened to him had he not died?
That's the question that I was going to go with. He did so much in such a short period of time. It would have been very interesting to see how much farther he would have went. How much more and how much bigger influence he could have had, and quite frankly, it may have never gotten very far past where it was, considering there was still a lot of anxiety toward the gay community. I mean, it's a lot more, we're a lot more open to it now.
Well, we look back on it, you know, 30 years of perspective. It's not such it's not such a shocking thing.
30 years ago, it would have been shocking to see on television during the Oscars. They did this. They did a couple different sequences where they did like all the comedies of the year, all the romances of the year, all the action movies of the year. During all the romance movies of the year, they showed a bunch of scenes where the lead actors kiss. Mm-hmm. They had scenes with Harvey and Scotty kissing. Mm-hmm. And it was right in there amongst all the other male-female couples.
It was just another one.
30 years ago, we would not have seen that.
No, it 30 years no ago, way. That would have been an X-rated scene.
Yes, it would have. There would have been angry letters. There would have been fines.
That would
have
been an X-rated movie.
Yeah,
period.
Probably, yeah.
And that would have never got into distribution.
Yeah, it would have never been on. It would have never been on television. That's for sure.
And you look at television from the 70s. Just unremarkable it is with what their subject matters are. You know, the biggest crisis you see in a domestic comedy in the 70s. Is, you know, Alice burns the beans or something, and you know that's the whole plot summary for the whole thing.
So I don't know that this movie lends itself to a whole lot of questions or comments from the little bit of the peanut gallery that we have left in the chat room.
And thank you, Peanut Gallery, for being patient with us.
And one of them is Adam, who is not here this evening. Yeah, Adam's been making a few comments throughout. he said it's pretty much a straightforward movie. He thought it should have won. I was really glad to see that Sean Penn won Best Actor for it. One of the comments I made Sunday morning after, you know, getting home, sleeping in, and to my wife, to my wife, she asked, you know, what my opinion was of which movie should have won and things like that. And I kind of laid out my opinions to her. And when I got to Best Actor, I said, you know, I can't speak for The Wrestler, which everybody says is going to win. But if Sean Penn wins for Milk, it is deserved because he did a fantastic job. And if it weren't for The Wrestler, I would think he would win hands down. I didn't see any better acting in it in the other four movies that we saw.
Well, Mickey Rourke as The Wrestler is more like an autobiographical piece of Mickey Rourke. So he's just playing Mickey Rourke.
And see, I haven't seen The Wrestler yet. Mm. So I really couldn't speak to that. And, you know, with any confidence that he should or should not have won that for that role. I said for the movies that I've seen, Sean Penn should win, and he did. I believe it was deserved. It was absolutely deserved.
Yeah. Again, the reason why Slumdog took top honors is because a Horatio Alger story always is much more appealing.
And Slumdog had a lot going for it. I'm sure we'll talk about it when we actually get around to talking about that, because we are going to touch on the other Oscar movies over the next couple of weeks, month or so. We'll probably take some breaks in there at some point just to break it up.
All right, so we won't melt down your minds.
Melt down the audience, period. The Slumdog had a lot going for it in that it's one of those rare movies that is, it's a feel-good story, it's an underdog story, it's a romance, it's a gangster movie, but it actually balanced all of them very well and told a cohesive story, and I think it did justice to all those different genres and the tropes within those genres. And that's how it succeeded. I think that's ultimately why it won. There was a lot there and a lot going on.
And also, it was a very technically difficult movie to make.
Yes,
I mean, they filmed it pretty much all with handheld cameras.
Right. And with a lot of young or child actors.
Unknowns, too.
Yes.
I mean, Bollywood has been, you know, rising in the United States for several years, but it's still not it's still not mainstream enough.
Yeah, yeah. So, well, if no one from the chat room has anything, I think we're about to call it a night. Next week, we're going to be talking about Frost Nixon and the movie Dick. So just to kind of mix it up, we're gonna have a little bit of fun with that one also. But and Knockwood, Tony number two will be back next week, and.
And one last comment too: if you decide to watch these movies in to get them in DVDs and watch them, the best order to watch them in is would be do The Reader first, then Frost Nixon, then Milk, Benjamin Button. And then, lastly, Slumdog, because then it kind of forms a nice timeline story arc.
Yeah, it does. It does, and you're ending. I think you're ending on kind of a high, yeah. Too.
And you end on contemporary high too.
And it helps. The first year I did this,
yeah, Frost Nixon and Milk dovetailed each other just perfectly.
Yes, yeah, they do. They do. It's two. Real world stories that
that one is the capping of an era, and the other is a capping of another era.
And I think for a young contemporary audience, probably a lot of the people that listen to this podcast, they're going to be things that aren't known quantities, or things that they know about vaguely, but don't really know the details of the Frost Nixon interviews of Harvey Milk. I had no who. I'll be honest. I had no clue who Harvey Milk was walking into this movie. I knew he was a gay activist who was killed, but that was only because I heard there was a movie
Mayor
called
Moscone
Milk.
Is the reason why they named Moscone Center.
Right, and I mean, I knew that there was a movie called Milk, and we were going to be watching it. And the only reason I knew as much as I did about it was because I didn't know what the movie was about. I had no clue who the guy was. So that's that. We'll see you guys next week. Daryl, thanks for coming out.
Thanks for having me.
And we'll catch you next time.